I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Mike Osterholm is with us from the Center for Infectious Disease at the University of Minnesota. Man has joined us so many times over the years. And Dr. Osterholm, who is as good as any epidemiologist on planet Earth, is with us on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus Hotline. Mike, a light topic. We were commenting before he came on. The Tribune today had a story about the number of people who are speeding right now. And, you know, that more people are paying attention. They're staying at home. So we were talking about in their younger days, if we had a bit of a lead foot, a young Mike Osterholm, was there a time with a certain car with a buddy or two when you drove a little too fast on the highway?
You know, I don't think there was. You know, I probably always have, how shall I say it, crowded the speed limit. But, you know, it wasn't that I had a car that I drove fast. I was born and raised in a family that didn't have a car. And so as the oldest child at 16, I had all my outside work and I bought a car. And it was priceless to me as something I'd never had. So I took pretty good care of it.
And, sure.
I can't say I was far from perfect, but I can't tell you that I ever spent a lot of time with a heavy foot.
What was that car, Mike?
It was actually an old 1957 Olds 98.
Sweet.
And it was sold to me by a school teacher in my hometown who had used it for many years as an old fishing car. And it was something that I could afford, and I needed it because at the time I had gotten a job with the Iowa State Hygienic Lab in the summers, the public health lab in Iowa, working on cross encephalitis and mosquito-borne disease, and I needed wheels to get around to the rural areas of where I lived. And so it was my castle, so I took good care of it.
Mm-hmm. That's smart. Did you know from very early in your life this is what you wanted to do?
Well, you know, I did, and I talk about that in my book. I was very, very fortunate. My father was a photographer at a local newspaper in Iowa, a small town. And the couple that owned the newspaper, the woman who was like a grandmother to me, but actually was kind of the mother of my soul, was one of the few people in Northeast Iowa back in the 1960s that subscribed to the New Yorker. New Yorker is, is a very high-end magazine. And there was at that time an author by the name of Burton Roget, who wrote a thing called The Annals of Medicine. It was really more about whodunit stories and, you know, kind of outbreaks, a lot of things from the CDC. And I just loved those. And so every time she'd get a New Yorker, she would call me up after she was done. I'd run up and get it, and I'd come home and read that. And probably one of the greatest kind of moments of my career was the very last outbreak that Burton Roget wrote up for The New Yorker was one that I led in southwestern Minnesota, outbreak of thyrotoxicosis that turned out to be something we thought was infectious. It was actually bovine thyroid in hamburger. And to be able to have been a young boy so encouraged by and really just my role model is to be able to actually do a story with him and it be his last story was a gift to my career. He was a remarkable man. He could tell a story like very few people.
That's a great way to have that experience and just to stimulate it even further. I want to talk about your podcast because you've been kind enough to join us for a long, long time. Your podcast is becoming just a must listen. You have an episode that has dropped today. Tell people what is on that podcast and how people can consume it.
Well, you know, we're in a tough time. You know, I think that, you know, we surely can look at the public health implications of this. I mean, people who don't understand the significance of this disease, it went from not even on the top 100 causes of death 60 days ago to now the number one cause of death in this country on any one given day. And it is really a very, very significant public health challenge. I think we have misunderstood what's going to happen. Only about 5 to 15% of the people in this country who have been infected to date. Here, we have a long ways to go to get to 60 to 70% of the population that will become infected over time before this virus slows its march. It'll hit a point where we call herd immunity and will slow down its transmission. Now, the one thing that could save us from getting to 60 to 70% with disease is going to be having a vaccine, but we don't see that forthcoming that soon. So I think that one of the challenges we have today is how do we tell this story in Minnesota? How do we tell this to the public? And one of the things I try to do in this podcast is explain that, you know, people are hurting clearly from the standpoint of the disease, loved ones dying, challenges, but we're also hurting economically. Society as we know it's hurting. Healthcare workers who are still going to work with not enough protective equipment. And so what I just try to do is cut through that and just tell it straight as I can. And that's what I think this podcast is about, is my personal reflection on the science and what we know and don't know. You know, this outbreak now has been dominated by long-term care. It's meatpacking locations, prisons, homeless shelters, and then I add in cruise ships, all what we call congregate living or working areas, which are tight spaces, meaning people are close together, and all it takes is one person to go into a nursing home as an employee or a visitor with the virus, and it blows up like a match in a gas can. Same true with these other ones. In 6 months, these will hardly have any impact at all on our pandemic because we'll have burnt through them. Then we're going to see a lot of additional cases in people who are going to be you and me. That's mm-hmm. what I try to get across. And what can we do about it? It's not enough just to tell people there's a problem. You got to tell them, what can we do about it?
And well, so I want to pick up on that. Mike Ostrom is with us because when we finished up last week, the last thing you said to me is, let's talk more about how we're going to live with COVID-19, you know, in the short term and in the long term. So in the short term, when we have this perpetual debate, and you've laid it out again, the small percentage you have it now and heading to 60 to 70% and the power of testing and antibodies, and at the same time, the desire people have to get back to some normalcy. How do we thread that needle right now? How do we live the appropriate way with respect for the power of this virus and also the desire and what we can do in having some normalcy back in our life?
Well, first of all, it's really very important to understand that this is a long-term issue. This is going to last for months. This is not short-term. And so whatever we do this week or next week is surely important, but it's just going to be one more week, and it's going to be many, many weeks with this. And we have to have people understand that. And some people will say, well, you just scare the hell out of us when you do that. And my message is, it's not my job to scare you out of your wits, it's scare you into your wits. What are we going to do about it? So you just have to start thinking about this. And as I've said many times, we can't go to the extremes of a total lockdown like we did in Wuhan and, you know, bring people to basically their homes and only their homes for many, many, many weeks. And so that's not going to work. We will kill society as we know it today. At the same time, we can't let this go willy-nilly because this virus is going to be a challenge. Even if we try our best efforts, we are going to see big bursts of cases. They're going to substantially challenge us in our communities. But how do we handle that? We can't let healthcare workers be put at risk dying every day because they're going to work without protective equipment. If we overrun the intensive care beds in our health hospitals around this state, not only will COVID-19 patients die, but people with heart attacks, people with strokes, people who are in automobile accidents will also die because we won't be able to provide the care. So what we got to do is thread that needle in between with what I call threading it with the rope. You know, and this is where some of us are trying very hard to have this discussion right now. How do we release and relax these recommendations, for example, among the youngest in society, young adults, people who don't have underlying health problems like obesity or heart disease or certain kinds of cancers that put them at much higher risk. People who basically at this point don't even know necessarily they're at risk because we haven't done a good enough job telling them who is likely at risk. And so I think that's what we need to do, is just much more communication. We are so caught up in political debates that we're missing the very point. What people are hungry for is just tell me the truth.
Okay, so let me pick up on that. For the 20 to 30 to 40-year-olds, whatever the age might be, who are stronger, who may have had this, and they were asymptomatic, or they had it, and it wasn't pleasant for a while, but they now are ready to go back into their life. What should those people be doing today, in fact, here in Minnesota?
Well, first of all, we have to make sure they really had it. And let me say, in each instance here, I want to be very respectful, because we've had young people in Minnesota who have gotten and have died, who had no underlying health problems.
Yep.
And we don't want to diminish that. But when you look at the big picture of risk in life, I mean, when I drive my car, you know, if I worried that risk for a young adult was a substantial issue, I'd never let him in a car. And so we have to understand is that risk is very different for that person today with COVID-19. Then say, for example, the person who is 68 years old with underlying heart disease, where they may have a 1 in 3, 1 in 5, 1 in 8 chance of having a very serious illness and even potentially dying. Those are so different that's what we have to do. So Chad, what we have to have is this honest discussion. You know, we've been having discussions in the intensive care world for some time about how do you allocate ventilators when you're running out? Hard questions. They're like life and death questions and answers. But we've legitimized and we've said it's okay to talk about that, because from a medical ethics standpoint, we have to make a choice. What we haven't had is that same okay to have conversations in our society about who is it that should be allowed or permitted or encouraged, whatever you want to call it, that they can get back into everyday life. And how do we then work hard to protect the people who are at highest risk? Because this virus is going to go to 60 or 70% no matter what we do.
Right.
It'll
and as you said,
if we're able to mitigate it, and that's right. What we hope to do, is take longer and maybe get a vaccine. If we could get only 30% of the population infected or 40 and have a vaccine to finish off those last 40%, wouldn't that be a great, great outcome?
Let me get to two last points, and I know you have to go. The testing question has been out there forever, right? And we'd all like to have significantly more tests available. When the president's spokeswoman, Kayleigh McEnany, was asked about this yesterday, it was probably an odd question. I mean, are we going to get to a point where every single person can be tested? And she said, well, what would we do? We would test people, and then do we need to test them the next day and the next day? For us, for you in particular, to feel more comfortable at this, knowing that we need to get to what you said is the 60-70%, where do we need to get in our testing?
Testing today should absolutely be available 24/7 on the spot when you have signs or symptoms of COVID-like disease. No one should be denied a test immediately, and the results back quickly. If you're a healthcare worker or you're a first responder, where if you have some symptoms of an illness that may or may not be COVID, we need to test you, because you're going back into an environment where you might transmit to patients, and that would be a big risk. So we want to make sure that we're also protecting the patients by testing there. If we could just accomplish that right now, that would be a major piece. This week, as you know, last week I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, highly right. critical of the FDA because yep. of the wild, wild west nature, which they were allowing all these various tests on the market.
And you told us weeks before that a lot of these tests were junk.
They were junk. And FDA announced, as you know, earlier this week that they are now going to reevaluate all these tests, and they've given manufacturers 10 days to provide comprehensive information that they work. So we were glad that the FDA responded to that kind of situation, and that's what we need. So, but we should be able to have the kind of testing we need to know. And if I'm positive, then I need to let the people in my life know that, you know, you need to understand if you were near me or I may expose you somehow, that you need to be mindful yourself of the signs and symptoms and how that's going to happen and what, you know, why over the next 10 days to 14 days you need what you need to do. So we need to do that. But again, I come back to the fact that then that means we have to provide people with the information to understand, what does this mean I've been exposed? What do I mean I have to stay right. Sheltered in place for 10 days? Do I have to do that? What does this mean if I don't have food? We just have a lot of questions that the public deserves an answer for. And that's where I think at this point, if I could say anything, over-communicate, communicate. I can't say that enough times.
We love when you communicate with us, sir. I know we're going to talk next Thursday at 105. Stay safe. Get a little rest.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
We have to end this call on a very. Did you see that the Koreans are now playing baseball?
I did. I haven't.
Empty stadium. But the TV has gone off the charts.
Yes.
You know, this is what we need to find ways in this country
right now.
With, when we have these ups and down moments, you know, if we can do things safely, we need to do them. You know, so. Boy, wouldn't it be a great day if we could get the Twins back and play in a stadium? Well, nobody's there.
We're
protecting people, but the TV is going to be great.
Well, it was,
that's
you know,
we need.
Right. Bravo to the Saints. They unveiled a plan yesterday, and maybe it doesn't happen there. Major League Baseball is telling some of their players to get ready that we might be looking at July, and it goes back to what you said: over communicate what we can do. And see which path we can follow with the known factor that if we have to adjust, we have to adjust quickly.
You know, I'm one of those people that don't believe in A plus B plus C plus miracle. You know, the beam me up scouting machines just don't work that well.
Yeah.
But I'm also somebody that does believe A plus B plus C can sometimes give you an incredible result.
Yeah.
That's what we need to be thinking right now. We need to be thinking creatively. We need to be thinking strategically. How do we combine those two? That's what America needs right now.
Always appreciate it, sir. We'll talk next
week.
Thanks,
Chad. Have a good day.
You
too.
Thanks.
See you later. Thanks. Bye.
Dr. Michael Ostrom, kind enough to join us again next Thursday. He's right back with us at 1:05.